To another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, I am honored to have with us Gabrielle Magid, who is the founder and CEO of Stronger Than Stigma in Florida. Thank you so much for being with us, Gabrielle.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
This is super cool. First and foremost, it's been great getting to know you over the past year. I know we met right before COVID started last January or February of 2020 at an event in Austin, Texas. You were in town. And that was super cool just meeting you there. I mean, as people can see, I mean, usually we publish the audio and at a later point we'll cut out clips, but Gabrielle just has it all. Her energy, it just radiates off of you. And it's so awesome to obviously to be in your presence, but then I feel it, you know, through Zoom, even in a setting like this. So I really appreciate that you're here on this episode. I'm really excited to talk with you about obviously what you're doing with Stronger Than Stigma, talk about mental health also in the nonprofit space. And then since you're doing this as a millennial, talking about that, because I think there's a lot of really relevant things that you've gone through the past 7 years from starting this organization to where you are now. And a lot of things that candidly older nonprofits that have either been around for a long time and or that have boards and staff members that are, let's say 40 plus could probably really relate to some of the things you're doing to target. But with all that said, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited. I'm a huge fan of yours and Charity Charge. So it's an honor for me to be here too.
Awesome. Yeah, we really appreciate that. It was cool. Can we start there actually? Because we'll get into your organization. I'm just curious, you know, when we first met, I mean, what was relevant to you about Charity Charge? Because I know almost like instantly you signed up, which was super cool. So I'm curious if you just take us through that. Like, what was your, kind of first impression of what we were doing and how did it relate to you running an organization as you think about the operations and finances?
Totally. So it's funny because I feel like timing is everything. And I met you right as I was kind of on my last nerve with my financial institution where we do our banking here in Jacksonville, Florida. I had been trying to get a credit card for my, it's a business, it's still a nonprofit, but for my business for about a year and a half, applying and getting denied and then being told, this is how you can improve your application. And still, waiting for feedback and it being, no, I'm sorry, but we can't, give you a line of credit. And then even in reading these applications, it would have required a personal guarantee or guarantor. I forget, you know the language better than I do.
Got it.
A nonprofit has expenses and it's, I think also I had just taken a course on cybersecurity. It was part of a nonprofit executive leadership program that I, had graduated from. And the last lecture was about cybersecurity and how dangerous it is to use your debit card for transactions on the internet. And yet that's the only card that I had access to. And so, I start freaking out. There's nothing I can really do about it in terms of, having a credit card. And then I meet you and you're like, well, wait, we're designed, to help nonprofits overcome this hurdle because we know that it exists and, sign up with us. And you told me about all the cool perks about, even if you're a young nonprofit, you will extend that line of credit, whether it's, it's lower and you earn, I guess the right to have more credit with you guys if you behave and pay your bills on time. It was just so serendipitous. And, even in booking my trip to Austin, I didn't have Charity Charge before that. So it's a situation where, you had to charge on your debit card or you know, to protect myself, pay on my personal credit card and then reimburse myself. And it's just so many steps and so much hassle when it could be, you know, a smooth, seamless transaction like it is now that we have charity charge.
Thank you. That's we're here. I appreciate you saying all that. I'm glad that we were able to step in and be able to help, you know, in that situation. It's crazy to me. And I look forward, you know, as we getting this thing rolling, I want to pass laws. I mean, I think it should be illegal for banks to force anyone running a nonprofit to personally guarantee their credit card and kind of just shove nonprofits in a box to match and, you know, have them basically give them all these predatory financial products. So
yeah,
I'll
sign that petition.
Good. Okay. Yeah. We're going to fight that crusade. I mean, we want to set up a C4 and do advocacy and lobby and
yeah,
get on down to Capitol Hill. But I appreciate you saying that and setting the stage in context, right? And so that's how we've been able to build the relationship that we have going here personally and professionally, which I really consider you a friend. And so I'd love for you to share with us, you know, why, what is Stronger Than Stigma? Why were you motivated to start it? And what's some of the work that you've been doing over these past 7 years?
Sure. So Stronger Than Stigma is a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to mental health advocacy for millennials by millennials, but not limited to millennials, because we found that our messaging resonates with people of all generations. But the idea was to create a for us, by us social movement. And in saying that, I mean, we've been there. We understand what it's like to struggle with mental health issues. We know what it's like to be in this stage of life because we are there right now. And we understand also, based on personal experience, that a lot of times when you start to struggle or feel, you know, not quite like yourself, the first person that you're going to reach out to is probably a friend or a peer. I don't really like the word peer. It's kind of like a loaded term historically, topic for a different day, but, you know, you're going to reach out to somebody your age and confide in them more as a friend than maybe call up a psychiatrist or a therapist right away and begin a relationship, you know, out of the blue. So a lot of times that, you know, first step, seeing somebody like you, you know, in the sense of going through the same things in life, maybe in the same spot, whether in school or in, you know, starting out in their careers, it's nice to be able to empathize with people in your stage of life, basically. And nobody else in the mental health sphere and nonprofit world was really serving this generation. Like, there was a clear void and gap in between services provided, which are amazing and necessary, but recognizing too that there's this whole other piece of like the social aspect of what it's like to struggle, and the fact that there is so much stigma around reaching out for help. You know, I had personally experienced it with my own struggles with depression and anxiety, and, you know, feeling like I kind of had to hide the fact that I was struggling, and then feeling kind of empowered by telling my story to friends and hearing that they had stories too, and really wanting that energy and that community for everybody, you know, regardless of what your background was or what your culture was. It became very clear that that stigma was present, you know, maybe more so when you talk to, you know, different people with different life experiences. But
I want to jump in there because, sure, first of all, I think that there can never be too many or enough resources focused on mental health and programs, solutions, tools, services for depression, anxiety, creating community, connectiveness, you know, breaking down barriers of people feeling isolated. But what I want to ask you to go a little deeper on is, in what way didn't it exist, right? So, I'm really trying to learn, not challenge you, but I think about like my my own self, and I'll open up further. I'm not like keeping it in. I'll share some of my personal, you know, story with this. But, Yeah. I mean, in what ways, when you, what did you realize like wasn't out there in the millennial, mental health space?
Sure. So historically, I guess I'm going to get to the definition of a peer that's historically been out there. So it is a conversation for today. Who knew? so historically, awesome established organizations like NAMI that I really, really look up to, right? And have been functioning and saving lives longer than I've been alive, right? Yep. They define peer as anybody who has the same diagnosis. So basically, they offer support groups and they will say, you know, hey, this is for depression and anxiety. And people of all ages and all backgrounds and all circumstances in life are gathered in a room to talk about the shared diagnosis. And maybe they're on the same medications, you know, and having the same symptoms, but they have nothing in common, you know? I think that it's intimidating for a millennial or younger to walk into a room filled with, you know, older and wiser adults who have seen more of the world, you know, and are having this experience and looking through a different lens when they're talking about their struggles. So there was nothing really, you know, uniting people based on generation. And also there's generational divides too. I always say, you know, our grandparents denied that mental health was a thing. Our parents snuck off to therapy. And then we're here to talk about it, break down barriers, and make sure that, you know, everybody coming up the ranks, you know, who's younger than us never has to deal with it. That they're asking, you know, what stigma? Why? You know, what's the big deal? I go to therapy every Thursday. And that's the vision that I have for, you know, Stronger Than Stigma and for our world at large. Like, I don't understand why reaching out for help can be a sign of strength in any other arena. And yet when it comes to your brain, which is also an organ, it doesn't apply. You know, it's a weakness or something wrong with you. All sure. of these things that we hear and that are wrong.
I love how you articulated that sequential buildup from generation to generation, which led to sort of a revolution. Why do you think that was the progression? I mean, in some respects, like I can think about it just like, you know, other social issues and other, you know, things that we have had around and maybe like closed behind like a closet door, you know, forever. And like, you know, it's just like with the times and the passing decades and generations, you know, things build up and then sort of the cup overflows type of thing. But any thought or just like either opinion or like historical perspective about like mental health that you think there's sort of this, what seems like at least some level of awakening? I would add, like, my last point is obviously the communication barriers are so interconnected now that it's way easier also to like accelerate a movement. Or, you know, if everyone's feeling it, then like everyone can jump on, whether you live in, you know, this city or that city.
Right. No, I think and like you're talking about, with a lot of different social causes, things always start out as taboo. And I think that as long as human beings have been on the planet, there have been mental health issues, you know, just like any other organ breaks down or needs, you know, tweaking and medicine sometimes and, you know, treatment, so does your brain. And I think that, you know, I was just having an interesting conversation with a psychiatrist actually that was talking about how, like when we lived in tribes, like back in the day, you know, if somebody was perceived as a threat or weaker or whatever, the way it was survival. So it was all about how we treated that person. You know, if they seemed weaker, we built them up and we took care of them. You know, you see that less and less today. But also if somebody was treated like a, you know, considered a threat, they were ostracized. And so I think somewhere along the line, we, you know, continued to ostracize people, and we didn't necessarily continue to, you know, foster carry
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking about also like the rise.
That's very historical, by the way. That's like, you know, writing on tablets instead of.
Sure. Well, that's also going way back. I mean, I was also going to add out that if you were too weak, I mean, you were just also pushed out, right? Or
probably, yeah.
You know, sort of taken advantage of. But I also think there was the rise of probably like over institutionalization, right? So people that were just completely misdiagnosed, and then it was such a, you know, very like taboo or scary thing to be maybe like, what if I go to get therapy because I need this? And they'd say, oh, you need, you know, we're going to lock you away in the,
right,
in the, you know, state institution or something like that. So there's probably a lot of things, but either way, we are where we are here today. What, I mean, are there any things off the top of your head? I mean, how sort of big of a market are you serving? How big of an issue is this? Any statistics, trends, things like you can talk about in terms of, not specifically, we'll get into like some of the milestones for Stronger Than Stigma, but just kind of at large, because it seems like it's very prevalent and you know, opening up with you, I'll just share with you too. I mean, my family fortunately was very bought into, you know, the aspect of therapy and everything. So, I mean, I remember, I think I probably went to like see a therapist when I was maybe like 12 or something.
That's awesome.
And, you know, and then I would go there off and on. I mean, it wasn't like a consistent forever thing. And I think part of it now, I look back at my personality. I mean, I think I probably first went in just because I was like, I didn't want to do my homework, you know? And it's like, I went to like a private school or a prep school. And then it's sort of like, oh no, like what's wrong with Steven? Like he doesn't want to do his homework or whatever. There were probably other things like, you know, it's hard for me to put it in, but at least my parents were like trying to, you know, get me help or whatever. So it was never really a stigma for me to go in just because that was around it. But like throughout the years, I mean, I even think back to, I mean, obviously I want to keep like confidence. I'll just say like a really close friend. I was, this is years ago, but like one day it just all came out and I was like, you know, her sharing with me like depression and things I was upset about. And I'm just like, have you not gone to a therapist? You know? And then when I brought it up and I was like, go, it was like, no, I can't go. I'll be a failure if I go see a therapist, you know? And I was trying to say, hey, if your arm was broken, you'd go to a doctor. If you're having bad allergies, you'd go. Like, this is a trained medical field. They're right there. Like, go. So anyway, I'm punting it back to you. What do you say?
No, I mean, and that's exactly what we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish. Like, my whole philosophy, we started this back when I was in college. So I was 20 years old. I think this was right before my 21st birthday that Stronger Than Stigma, you know, was created. And we just recognized the need to change the culture around asking for help. And in order to do that and reach our demographic, you got to make it cool to talk about. You know, you got to make it accessible, but even like using words like that, it's not how we speak. So you have to talk the talk and walk the walk and let people, you know, figure out for themselves that really cool people that they look up to have had these same struggles. Just whatever you can do to facilitate that asking for help. And Stephen, you were asking me in terms of like, how big of a problem is this? It's freaking huge. The World Health Organization was reporting before the pandemic, right? So this was early 2020, that depression was going to be the leading cause of disability worldwide. And this is, you know, by 2021. And this is prior to the pandemic, right? So the pandemic has only exacerbated existing issues. And then I'm sure, and I 100% sure that it has also created new issues because you have these, you know, people are hardwired for connection, and loneliness causes all sorts of ailments, you know, mental health and physical health wise. And also, I would say mental health is physical health because it's your brain. So ding, ding on that. But, you know, loneliness really does take a toll on people. So, you know, 1 in 4 people struggle with a mental health issue at some point in their lifetime. And I would argue with you that that statistic is, you know, wrong, and it's underrepresenting the problem, because that 1 in 4 is only counted when they reach out for help. But there are so many other people that, due to stigma or due to the fact that, you know, treatment is inaccessible to them for whatever reason, they're not going, so they're not getting counted. And mm-hmm. and so I would say it is a much larger issue, and it touches every single person on this planet, whether it's they themselves are struggling or someone they love is struggling. So this is huge, and it's never been more important than it is now. You know, throughout this pandemic and then afterwards, we're also going to see some very interesting developments as things return to, you know, the new normal. People's mental health has just been through the ringer this last, you know, year and a half. And I think we're going to need continued support in this area.
For people listening to this right now, I think that you and I being vulnerable is probably making people resonate with this and realizing that maybe they've never opened up. What would be the first thing you'd say if someone came to you and just said, "Hey, I've never shared this with anyone, but I'm really having trouble"? Like, what would be, you know, and this would be anyone, not, you know, just in Florida or near you, what would you suggest for them to get help or educated or resources? What are some kind of just go-to things people should know about from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I've been on the receiving end of that conversation, you know, more times than I can count now. And I feel honored each and every time somebody shares their story with me. A lot of times, you know, it's painful to listen to somebody else's pain. But I think that the most important thing that you can do is to confide in somebody that you trust. And when you do that, I think it's very important that the person that you're confiding in recognize that they're not there to fix the problem. They're there to listen and provide support by just being there. You know, that person needs to feel safe and comfortable being vulnerable, and know that the other person is kind of like their testing ground almost. Like, hey, can I come out and be honest about how hard things have been? And then, you know, after that person on the receiving end, so, you know, if it were me in that circumstance had listened, I would suggest, you know, hey, I hear you. I understand. I've been there. Have you ever considered seeking professional help? And then I would kind of break down like your options at that point. And I always recommend when you're starting out with professional help, going to see like a therapist first, because they've seen it all. So they can kind of tell you like, hey, from what you're telling me and the way you're shaping your story and what I'm hearing, I think this is depression, anxiety, OCD or whatever, and then direct you to your next step of treatment. I don't think that there's any reason to kind of go from 0 to 60 from, you know, never sharing your struggle to then, you know, going and seeking, you know, the advice of a psychiatrist right off the bat. You know, I think that people's relationship with treatment also is different. There are a lot of modalities out there and more, you know, unique ones are being developed at this point in time. But I think that people are scared also because they're worried that, you know, oh, if I tell somebody I'm depressed, I'm just going to be given an antidepressant. And, you know, that's not, I don't want to take that. Like, that's not the solution that I'm looking for. And it's like, okay, well, maybe you can talk it out. So talk to somebody who can help you talk it out first. And then if you need it, you need it. And don't be ashamed of it.
What are transitioning here also kind of now back to Stronger Than Stigma, what are on like sort of a, you know, I hate to say like on a day to day, but what are some of the practical things that Stronger Than Stigma is doing, you know, 7 years later? What does the organization provide?
So we are all about reaching our demographic, right? And changing culture. We know that our people are online. And so producing and putting out digital content, whether on Instagram, Facebook, we're not the best at Twitter, but we have one, you know, reaching our people where they're at is super duper important. And that's like on a daily basis, right? You might not see a post from us on a daily basis, but that's consistent, right?
Sure.
So then prior to the pandemic, our specialty was really in live events and creating community based around, you know, a lot of comedy, honestly. Like comedy is really part of our brand ethos because we figure like, yeah, we've been there, we've done that, let's laugh about it. And laughter is a universal unifying force. You know, we started a trademarked comedy tour called the Nobody's Happy Comedy Tour, where, you know, I went on the road with comedian Josh Novy of the Amazon Prime special Fat Veteran, and we toured the East Coast doing, 12 shows in 6 states in 25 days in late 2018. And, you know, that was how we were expanding our reach then.
That's
in
awesome.
Person. Yeah, it was really cool. And for us too, whatever we produce and put on a stage, like, yes, the content and the quality of the content is important to me, but it's really important that the people in the audience be able to look to their left and right and understand that everyone that's there is kind of brought there for a shared reason, you know, and really it resonates that they're not alone, to be able to like be in the presence of others who this kind of content appeals to. You know, because whatever we do, it's all built around the idea that we're building community. You know, we created the first ever pop-up shop around mental health awareness called The Living Room. And that debuted in Jacksonville, Florida, in a storefront downtown, like right in the heart of everything during Mental Health Awareness Month in May 2019. And our dream is to take that on the road and pop up in as many cities as we can. But obviously those plans were halted a little bit and changed by the state of affairs in 2020 and the pandemic, and we want to keep everybody safe. So we pivoted and hosted a 31-day virtual event marathon online, you know, having Zoom sessions and also streaming on our Facebook, mostly our Facebook platform. And just, again, reaching people where they were at, which was at home and scared. So trying to provide interesting and also useful information, programming, all sorts of things. And that was awesome. And then that led us into realizing like, wow, we've been around 7 years, like, and our anniversary is in August. So we launched our first ever crowdfunding campaign. We felt like, you know, we had really engaged with our people online, and so they were kind of ready to receive that information. We had never done it before, but you know, we launched our hashtag Cheers to 7 years fundraiser, and we just asked our demographic, our people, anybody, you know, who had gotten value from everything that we've done, because it was free online too. You know, we wanted to really make sure things were accessible. But we just said like, hey, can you spare $7 to show us that you care, that we exist, and you want us to continue.
I'm so glad that you brought this up unprompted, because you know, we contributed to that campaign, and I saw that pop up on Instagram, and I just thought, how can I not contribute? And, you know, this, I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that you're doing and expertise that you've learned over these past 7 years, and just being who you are and in your just upbringing and everything, that could really relate, that I think some other nonprofits could learn from in terms of thinking about how to reach, you know, a younger audience, right? And make things more accessible. And I think what was amazing about your ask there is how easy and accessible it was, that it was just really a no-brainer. And obviously this is like anything. I mean, you want to get, when you're running an organization, you want to cast your net as wide as possible.
Right.
Obviously set it up in a way with your website and how people are donating so that it's not hard for you to be able to take in, if whether it's 7,000 or 7 million people want to donate to you. But I find that I think a lot of organizations struggle and choose not to make small dollar asks, right. which then means they leave out a lot of people from getting, you know, involved at all, or just taking the first step with them. So I'm curious, like, just your perspective on just what you've seen, like, fundraising from millennials, and your advice to other nonprofits that maybe the people leading it aren't millennials. What's your advice to them to fundraise and, you know, really build trust and rapport with a younger demographic?
Sure. I think we get overlooked a lot. I think that, I think this goes across the board. I think that if somebody, steps up to become not only, you know, a supporter of your organization, like passively, but then actively becomes engaged in your mission by becoming a donor, they need to feel like their money is the greatest thing since sliced bread to that organization, right? Like, no matter what dollar amount or how many zeros come after it, that needs to be celebrated. And I've gone to countless seminars where they talk about donor retention and writing thank you notes and whatever. And yes, I think it's important, but I think that there are very old school ways of fundraising that really haven't changed in the nonprofit sector for years and years and years. And the way that I approach things is like, how can we do things, how can we put our spin on them? How can we teach also along the way? And so a lot of millennials feel that they either don't have the means right now to be philanthropic, or feel that if they were to give $5 or whatever, you know, $7 in our case, that it might not be appreciated or celebrated because it's not 100 or 1,000 or whatever. And I think that because there's that misconception that millennials can't be philanthropists, and that the word philanthropy and philanthropist is reserved for, you know, just old white men who have amassed a fortune and at the end of their lives decide to, you know, donate the wing of a school. Like, yes, that's philanthropy, and that's on a large scale, and it's super important, and it has gotten us to where we are today. But I think people forget that we're the next generation of donors, and a lot of those, you know, old white men, and I don't mean to be derogatory when I say that, like, obviously there are women who are very philanthropic that are also elderly and whatever, but my point really is that organizations have to be cultivating the next generation of donors, because there are other donors, why they might be giving $50 million in a one-time gift towards the end of their life, like, they're not going to be on the planet forever. And then who's going to be the next person to give you that $50 million gift? And it starts by celebrating that $7. Like, let me tell you, like, I am in your shoes. I'm earning, you know, what you're earning, maybe a little bit less because I'm in the nonprofit sector. And yet I can spare $7, and I'm going to thank you for it. I'm going to say, oh my God, this is awesome, and ask that you grow with us, that it's a partnership, you know, rather than saying like, hey, we'll call you when we're 40, and have more disposable income. So I think
there's I want to jump in. I agree with everything you're saying. I want to add to it, Gabrielle, and share a few things. One of the biggest things you're talking about, I'll just add some numbers to it, is, and I pulled this up, so I knew the number was something like this, but I wanted to check a good source. So I'm on Forbes. Baby boomers, The generation of people born between 1944 and 1964 are expected to transfer $30 trillion, that's with a T, $30 trillion in wealth to younger generations over the next many years. The jaw-dropping amount has led many journalists and financial experts to refer to the gradual event as the Great Wealth Transfer. In no prior time in the history of America has such a vast amount of wealth moved through the hands of generations. So this is the opportunity, if you're running an organization, to ask for $1, $7, do whatever it is, start educating millennials and younger generations about your organizations and the great work that you're doing, because they're going to be the ones that are they'll either work for it themselves, which is great, or they're going to inherit hundreds of thousands, billions or billions of dollars, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it's like, this is fact. This is happening. So if you want to have success, so I think that right there is sort of the exclamation point on the reality of this. And you, I think, are very much taking a very pragmatic approach to it that is going to pay. You guys are already kicking butt now, but you're going to keep hustling and doing really well in the future.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, hey, that's our plan and our dream, right? So I appreciate it. And yeah, I appreciate it.
So you shared some stuff. I'm just curious, like, from your perspective, and I appreciate how you're just very open and transparent about things. I was having, it's not published yet, but I guess it'll be published after this, so I could say, I was speaking with another group we work with that is led by a fellow millennial. Her name's Rachel Hand. So she runs Family Promise North Shore Boston, which focuses on family supporting, you know, services and programs, resources for families that are experiencing homelessness in Boston. But what she was talking about, she termed it the nonprofit industrial complex. And she sort of was talking about all of basically the screwed up things that happen sort of outside and then also inside the nonprofit industry as a whole. I could prompt you more, but I'm just curious, like, you went at this, right? And you came into it, I'm sure, with the greatest of sort of like spirit, energy, beliefs. But from starting it to now, 7 years in, we already touched on, obviously, like the challenges of like dealing with banks and like the financial aspect of running a nonprofit. What are some other things that you didn't know about? And if you were saying this to someone that's considering starting a nonprofit, what should they be aware of that maybe was eye-opening to you, or sort of like, that's the way it's done? Or like, I thought everything was going to be awesome and perfect, and these people are mean. Like, I don't know.
I mean, in case this clip doesn't air, I'm sitting with my head in my hands.
Yeah, your posture changed, your body language. I've been reading a lot.
Oh my God. Wow. So yeah, I think that there's this, I love the way her name is Rachel.
Yes.
Okay. I love the way Rachel phrased that. There are so many inefficiencies and misconceptions and shady things that happen in this sector, and it's unbelievable. And I never knew, because I think that I was raised thinking about nonprofits the way any, you know, passive, you know, just like absorbent person, you know, I don't think you can move through the world without hearing about a nonprofit or a charity or whatever, but without really diving deeper and learning the ins and outs of the industry and whatnot, you wouldn't have this perspective. So you probably think like, oh, okay, a charity, you know, is run by, it's like, it's not a business. They don't make money. They're not supposed to have overhead. That's a huge myth, and it's very harmful, because there would be no programs if there were not people to run them, or, you know, an office building or a venue or whatever to host said programs. So the idea that nonprofits are supposed to, you know, get by on the hair of their chinny chin chins is ridiculous and harmful, because then people are comparing apples to oranges. You know, somebody can say, oh, 40% of your dollar goes to, you know, saving homeless people, whereas 60% goes to making sure the CEO has a fat paycheck. And in reality, that's not the truth. You know, you're hearing this dirty word of overhead, and it's not that. That's not the case. Like, in order for an organization to grow and to do more of its mission, it has to have resources and the capacity to do so. Otherwise, the mission will not get done. So that's one like rant and soapbox that I have, like the overhead myth. I also was shocked by how little innovation there is in this field. I think that every other industry is continually trying to, you know, change processes and adapt and find the next solution and whatever. And yet here's a whole sector that's pretty much operating the same way that it has since, you know, its origins. And I think it was like the 1960s, or I forget exactly when the government just said like, hey, we're going to create the third sector. You know, you fill in the gaps from what we're not able to provide for our citizens. And strategies haven't changed. And the textbooks that I, you know, was reading when I was minoring in nonprofit leadership are the same things that are, you know, A, being taught now, and B, that my predecessors have been reading since, you know, the beginning of time also. And then you don't really see leadership that, you know, you can look at a staff and everybody is over 40, you know, and having somebody who's 40 on their board is a, you know, is a big deal, or having somebody 40 in the organization, like people stay in their jobs forever. And so there's not a flow or creation of new ideas. And that's really frustrating. I mean, I could go on and on if you want me to, Stephen, but you can interrupt me if this is
no. Not, I appreciate.
It sounds kind of negative.
Well, it could sound negative. I think there's obviously a lot of ways to think about it. I think it's important to share. It's all about what is. It's all about reality, truth, and there's a huge separation that I see between people that work in the for-profit world and those that work in the nonprofit world. And part of it is, I think overall, I mean, a lot of it is around, you know, we're talking about one side of it. It's a huge industry. So it is what it is, you know, and this is a safe opportunity to talk about it. But I think that, you know, same thing. Look, there's a lot of challenge in the for-profit world, but on the nonprofit side, I think a lot of it, unfortunately, gets down to the mentality, because I think a lot of it, it's about like a scarcity and an abundance. I think it's a scarcity to change for new innovation. I think it's a worry about competition of like other nonprofits. So like there's such a, and been so many studies on lack of collaboration. I've started to, for some new initiatives that we're going to start partnering up with foundations, I've started to talk to a lot of people in the large foundation space. And a lot of them have told me, hey, look, we've tried to create collaboration and we've said to organizations, you know, we'll give you 5,000, we'll give you 5,000, we're together, we'll give you 80,000 if you go and like work together. And the groups are like, no, we just want the 5,000. We don't want to collaborate. So there's so many issues that I think are happening that are facing the nonprofit space. But I think it's important that we bring about these, you know, these issues and just sort of talk about it. And I think a lot of it's sort of like, you know, the idea of mental health. I think that a lot of people that are in the nonprofit world see these up close and personal, but they're afraid to voice it because they're worried about how will donors then perceive their individual organization. So I think in the same way that you're talking about bringing, you know, as an organization that's stronger than stigma, breaking through and bringing awareness about this to a community, I think that that's the first step here of just letting people that run organizations know that they can speak out.
Yeah. I would consider that one of my personal missions too. Like, I've had these lived experiences, and I think that it's important that people know. But also too, I think that we as passionate, cause-driven people who want to put our talents to use for good and for making change, we gravitate towards what we're taught, which is, you know, the nonprofit sector is where do-gooders go and where they make a difference. And, you know, I'm using that tone because that's how it's painted, you know, it's a fairy tale. And then you get in here and it's super cutthroat. And just like you're talking about scarcity and whatever, like, people don't want to share anything because they're concerned, you know, if they help you, then maybe their donor will think that, you know, you're the shiny new nonprofit on the block and they're going to donate to your cause rather than their cause. So there's no, you know, no reason for them to mentor you or, you know, give you a seat at their table and share wisdom with you because it might hurt them. And,
I want to say this too, like whenever it comes across, I mean, I'll share, I won't name the name, but I've encountered so many examples of what you're sharing, right? One of them was, trying to think how to protect the innocent here. But anyway, this was back when we had recently launched and we had our consumer card offering, which the idea was, an individual use that card and your cash back goes to the charity of your choice. So I'm down, meeting with this executive director, pretty accomplished person that had already run a couple of other organizations. I don't know, she was in her 50s, 60s, something like that. She's telling me how great it is, all of this. She got a card and she was pushing it out to her board members and everything. And then I said, oh, sounds like, you know, I can tell you've worked at a lot of other organizations. I would love to be put in touch with them so that we can get the word out and they can raise money. And she looked at me and she said, well, if I do that, they might promote it to the same donors and then they'll pick that nonprofit over mine. So I'm not going to, why would I do that? Why would I put you in touch with them? And I was just like, it like just stayed with me. And I just thought it was so off-putting that someone would say that to me.
Yeah.
And not me, like my ego, but just more that they weren't in it, you know, they were just in it for themselves. And that, you know, was just such an off-putting thing for me to hear.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that, because there are moments that have stuck out to me like that too, that are just, you know, burned into my brain. And I've kind of recognized there are times that I get burnt out, from dealing with just the status quo, because I think that the nonprofit sector is kind of, you know, it is the status quo in reality. And, you know, maybe that's a metaphor or maybe it isn't, I don't know, but, you know, it's alarming. And I feel like it changes people the longer that you're in it. And I've kind of noticed, I have to step back when I start to get cynical, because I recognize, like, all right, I have to play the game if I want to stay in this space. And it's important to me that all, you know, millennials and people in general recognize that they're not alone in reaching out for help with their mental health. Like, I that is my mission, and I really, really care about it. And I want that message to, you know, be baked into people's brains. But at the same time, I feel often and recently too, so I will be open about that, like, it's changed my personal mindset from being one where I would consider myself a generous person. Like, I like to share, I like to create in groups of people, you know, I do improv comedy. It's all about, you know, glorifying the whole, like the team being successful rather than one person looking funny and, you know, the rest of us looking like, oh, what the hell are we doing on stage? So I'm kind of, you know, I think that's part of who I am as a person. And yet I'm starting to notice that I'm getting worn down by the status quo of the nonprofit sector, to the point where I'm like, man, I'm becoming stingy. I'm becoming somebody that's like, whoa, I need to protect, you know, my terrain. And why do I feel taken advantage of? Because I think also being young in the field, people ask me to do things for free a lot. And I think that, and it's because I'm in the nonprofit sector, right? Because
what would be an example of that? When you say people, you mean other nonprofit organizations or?
It definitely happens with other nonprofit organizations. So I can understand, you know, financial hardship a little bit, but sometimes they're bigger organizations. So I think that, you know, they should understand that there needs to be, at least a recognition of time spent, whether or not it's like at value or just, you know, symbolic. It's just, it would be polite, right? And then even corporate partners who are like, oh, we know that this is important, but the budgets are frozen or whatever. Will you speak to, you know, our young professionals? And it's something where I'm torn, because it's like, of course I want to do the thing, but I also know that I have to look out for my organization and myself. And I'm being, you know, like super honest with you right now, because that's like a really uncomfortable conversation and dilemma that I have with myself. And when I voice it to my team, where I'm like, you know, I don't want to say no, but at the same time, unless I start putting my foot down and saying, you know, I can't do this without your support, because then I wouldn't be able to continue doing what I do full time, and being upfront about it. So that's hard. And I know some of my colleagues, you know, in the field who are older and wiser would not expect anything less, and that an organization approaching them wouldn't dare ask them to do something for free without, you know, offering some sort of non-monetary something, you know. Just
yeah,
like,
I hear you. Yeah. My just personal advice to you is that, you know, we live in a really large world with a lot of different people, personalities, businesses, nonprofits, religions, beliefs, value systems, all of that. The more you project who you are, which you do a really great job of it, the more you're going to bring in the people that match that energy. But of course, it's so big, you're going to have, just don't let let people that don't jive with you drown out the people that do, because I think there's way more. So, you know, I get that in different ways now, and I'm just sort of like, those aren't my people, you know. But I think that one of the things, there's a guy, he's Tony Robbins' son, his name is Jerick Robbins, and his book, one of the major premises is that everybody you meet is either a warning or an example. So, you know, I think that actually it's really awesome, because it's showing you that you're self-aware enough, right, to recognize what's up and what's not, you know, and who's who and who's not. So, but I also hear you with what you're saying, and just keeping up.
Thank you.
Because it's pretty great. So thank you so much. Look, for people that are interested in learning more, getting involved, how can they support you, find your website, find you on social media?
Totally. No, I would invite you to join the movement, is what we say. And so following us on social media would be awesome. Our Instagram and Facebook handles are, you know, the @StrongerThanStigma. Our Twitter is @STS_together, but like I was saying earlier, we're not the best tweeters. And then, you know, our website is strongerthanstigma.org, and you can see everything that we're up to. And there is also, a donate button there, and we would obviously love your financial support, but you know, it's really about relationship building. So I'd love for you to join the movement, see what we're all about. Send us an email, send us a message, whatever works, and let's figure out how to change the stigma together.
I love it. Thank you so much, Gabrielle, for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for having me and for all the work that you do.
I appreciate it. It's our pleasure.